Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a conservative law professor who once worked with Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor responds to anonymous clerks who've questioned her skills. But first, we've been talking about it for so long, you may think General Motors is already in bankruptcy, but the carmaker still has until Monday to work out a plan, and it suffered a big setback today when creditors rejected a swap of GM stock for debt. Chrysler, meanwhile, is before a bankruptcy judge today, hoping to escape liquidation by selling the bulk of its assets to a group headed by Fiat. Micheline Maynard is senior business correspondent for the New York Times. Mickey, let's start with General Motors first. What was the swap that GM was offering to its creditors? Why did those creditors reject that swap? And what does that mean?
Well, the swap, Robin, would have offered them initially about 41 cents on the dollar, but then General Motors later announced that it would be doing a reverse split of its stock. So shareholder value would have been incredibly diluted by the General Motors offer. And these bondholders looked at that and said, you know, we spent thousands and literally millions of dollars on our GM bonds, and we don't think this is worth it. So the offer went down to defeat.
Does it mean that they feel that they would get more or, you know, come out even after bankruptcy? Because does this mean now that GM is closer to bankruptcy?
Well, I don't think they're going to come out even in bankruptcy. You know, everybody takes a haircut, as they say. And different bondholders are in different positions. I mean, there are people who bought these bonds to pay for their kids' college educations. And some of the smallest bondholders, they don't have any leverage at all. But some of the bigger bondholders, and they actually formed a group, they are already negotiating with the Treasury Department in hopes that they can find a solution and maybe get a better deal than this tender offer would have been.
What about the workers, the union? UAW just agreed to accept a 20% stake in GM, just about half of what they were expecting, less than what they got from Chrysler. So are creditors rejecting losses that the union is accepting?
Well, the union workers, GM's union workers, are voting today on a proposal that would require concessions on their part. And it's pretty severe concessions. A lot of people are losing cost of living allowances. Retirees will lose some benefits. But they did get some gains. General Motors agreed that it would keep a couple of plants open to build small cars in the United States. And it agreed to reconsider some of the outsourcing that it was planning to do of vehicle production to places like China and Mexico. The UAW is going to get 17.5% of the new GM up front. And then they get warrants, which can be exchanged for another 2.5% of GM down the road. And all that depends on GM's restructuring and bankruptcy. So, you know, it will take quite a while for the UAW to actually see any return on this investment.
And meanwhile, Chrysler's attorneys are in court. They say only a sale to Fiat can save their company. How's that faring in the few seconds we have?
The judge is considering the sale today, and there are many objections to it, but could be by the end of today that Chrysler will be owned by Fiat.
Micheline Maynard, senior business correspondent for the New York Times, as the ground continues to tremble under the American car industry. Mickey, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
Well, we begin our next segment with two corrections regarding yesterday's coverage of Supreme Court Justice nominee Sonia Sotomayor. First of all, we joined a reported 2,000 media organizations in referring to her as the daughter of Puerto Rican immigrants. Her parents are not immigrants. They are U.S. citizens, as all Puerto Ricans have been since the Jones-Shafroth Act of 1917. Secondly, we mistakenly said that Judge Sotomayor's former law clerks made disparaging comments about her temperament and intellect. Nothing could be further from the truth. According to legal analyst Jeffrey Rosen, who interviewed clerks for an article in the New Republic, it was former clerks for other justices who made some disparaging remarks. Sotomayor's clerks said she treated them like extended family. They sang her praises as a demanding but thoughtful boss. But still, the comments of the disparaging clerks have been ricocheting around the blogosphere, and at least one interested observer is voicing his objection today. Gerard Magliocca was a summer intern for Sotomayor in the 90s, then a clerk in the Second Circuit Court in New York when she came there in 1998. He's now a law professor at Indiana University and a conservative. And Gerard, you write in the New York Times today that even while you disagreed with Sotomayor in some cases, there is no question that she should be confirmed. Why?
Well, because first of all, she has the intellectual firepower to do the job. She has the character to do the job. And she's an all-around terrific person. And those are the things that really matter for nominating a justice once you're within the range of saying that, well, Democratic presidents pick certain kinds of justices and Republican right. presidents pick other kinds of justices.
You're right. For those of us who think that intellectual rigor and fairness are the crucial factors, no matter which party the president, that's the determining factor. What do you think about the whisper campaign that she's a bully?
Right. Well, certainly I never saw anything like that. I mean, she's been terrific to lawyers in the cases that I observed. Judges are supposed to ask tough questions. If you don't ask tough questions, then you don't find out the things that you need to know to make good decisions. So if being a bully means she's asked tough questions, well, that's true. But I don't think that's something that we should be concerned about.
Well, in fact, you write that she was nurturing to you, a rookie intern, and sympathetic to rookie lawyers who made some real gaffes.
Right. What I talked about is a trial I saw where the prosecutor and the defense counsel, it was her first trial, and they did all sorts of very strange things that you would never do at a normal trial. And I think a harsh judge would have basically been on their case a lot. And instead, Judge Sotomayor tried as much as she could not to do that. And then afterwards, when the thing was all over, she asked them to come back and spoke with them at quite some length about how to think about trying cases in future. And I thought that was a really generous act.
Well, and there was another case. State workers took a child away from a father based on wrongful allegations. You and the judge you clerked for thought the state workers should have been found negligent. Judge Sotomayor was sympathetic to the state workers. So you disagreed, but still you write you found her judgment reasonable.
Right. Well, these are hard cases. So people in those sorts of situations often can reach different conclusions in good faith. And I never doubted that her conclusions were grounded in a close and solid analysis of the facts and the law.
Well, and you make another point that's interesting. People are talking about her background, her story. But you say her experience as a lawyer and a judge are more relevant to you. Few have actually strapped on a bulletproof vest and taken part in law enforcement raids as she did. Many are knowledgeable about labor laws, but few had something like the baseball strike to deal with as she did. And you say that it's this sort of broad background that's going to make her more relevant as a judge?
I mean, in particular, she's been a trial court judge, so she's had to deal with issues like criminal sentencing and evidence, and also she's been a prosecutor. So these are areas where the court could use another perspective. My judge used to say that it's really your experience that shapes your outlook, not your ideology.
Gerard Magliacca, a law professor at Indiana University, also a former clerk on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York, who for 13 years as both a clerk and a summer intern observed Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor at work. Professor, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Well, they may not be Supreme Court nominees, but more women will rise to top positions in a future workforce, and more jobs will be found in the bottom half of the country, from Nevada to Florida. These are two findings in the recent Time magazine cover story on the future of work. Today, we want to hear what else they found with one of the reporters, Stephen Gandell. Stephen, you found, first of all, the generational divide. Gen Ys, the 20-somethings just entering the workforce, wanting more flexibility than their parents ever had. Gen X's, born from 65 to 78, about to be in charge, and baby boomers, many of whom can't retire because they didn't save as much as they should have, and the retirement plans are bust. And you say that's a particular problem because retirement waves are important to smooth out recessions?
Right. When it wasn't exactly meant for this reason, but when they put in Social Security, it helped get us through the Great Depression because people were willing to leave the workforce. So those kind of forced retirements or
eased retirements, yeah.
That helps get people out. It creates more seats in the workplace, but also it doesn't remove that income. When the person retires, they're still guaranteed the certain amount of income, so they continue to be a consumer. And when that process doesn't happen, it can make downturns worse.
In fact, you write that some economists think the unemployment rate will surpass 10% for the first time in decades, in part because this retirement cycle has been disrupted and younger people aren't going to be able to get in. But then you were saying that companies are coming up with clever ways to get around this. For instance, boomers sharing jobs.
Yes. So what we were saying is that in the short term, this is going to be a bad thing. It's going to produce more unemployment. But in the long term, this could be a good thing because companies are going to have more choices. They're going to have a more diverse workforce. And they're going to have this kind of mix of experienced workers along with younger workers who may be willing to do more things that the kind of someone later in the career won't be able to do. So we see a lot of positives here. And the other thing that we learn when we talk to economists is that the economy is not stagnant. It's elastic. And so if there are more people who want to work, the economy tends to accommodate that. And when more people work, there are more people who can spend, and that generates more economic activity, and that generates more jobs. And the example we found of this was that when women entered the workforce for the first time, this is a new cohort, they were in the workforce, but they entered in the 60s and 70s in more numbers, and we didn't see longer-term unemployment go up. We saw it actually hit new lows. And that just shows how the economy can absorb this. And that's going to be what happens this time as the 65-year-olds and maybe the younger workers when they get to that age, we all decide to stay in the workforce longer.
Well, in fact, you say that the older workers are going to become a part of the 40% of the workforce that's going to be independent contractors. That's up from 26% today to 40% in 2019. So that's what some of the boomers will do, rent themselves out.
Yes, we think that there's going to be more independent workers because the problem is the number of seats at traditional corporations are going to fill up. And so these new people entering the workforce, the Generation Yers, are going to either be contractors or they're going to come up with new innovations and new technologies, and they understand things that the older workers don't. When I've talked about this article, some people of older workers have said, I don't understand that Twitter stuff. We need these younger workers. And so those younger workers are going to come up with, they're either going to decide they want to be independent contractors, they're going to come up with innovations that are going to create their own jobs. And that's how the economy expands when more people want to be on the workforce.
So both older and younger workers are going to be coaches, strategists, consultants, part-time workers, in part because Generation Yers, as you've been calling them, they don't have the same values as their parents. They don't see any need to stay in a company for a long time. So it sort of works out well that they have that thinking because they may not get the chance to do that. What about?
And it's good for companies, too, because these kind of legacy problems they've had, these big pensions for people who stay in their companies for a long time. Also, healthcare benefits. Generation Yers may not value healthcare benefits as much as some of the older workers. So they'll say, I'm more willing to be a contractor. I'm more willing to forego that for my flexibility. And that could be good for companies, at least now, that are looking to save costs.
Stephen Gendel, senior writer for Time Magazine, one of the reporters on a series of articles about the future of work. Here's another thing they found. We know there are going to be more high-tech jobs, but many of these jobs will be in consulting, working with, for instance, blue-collar projects like building bridges, but also helping people figure out their problems. McKinsey & Company, the big consulting group, says nearly 85% of new jobs created between 1998 and 2006 involved complex knowledge work like problem solving. So that's a field to look to. We'll be back with more with Stephen after a break. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Will there be a corporate ladder in your future, or will it be more like a vine, employees moving up and changing jobs and moving laterally? We've been speaking with Stephen Gendel, senior writer for Time Magazine. He and other Time reporters have written a series of articles on the future of work. They found more women will be at the helm of corporations. We recently saw Anne McCulhey, the CEO of Xerox, hand over the reins to another woman, Ursula Burns, who, by the way, becomes the first African-American to head a Fortune 500 company. And Time reporters predict more of this. A recent study of Fortune 500 companies found that companies with the most women in senior management had a higher return on equities by more than a third. In other words, they make more money. And Time found it's because women in management are more cautious and focus on the long term more than their male counterparts do. But, Stephen, where will the jobs be? You know, what geographic location? You have a map showing states that jobs are migrating to. Tell us about that.
So what we found is that in areas where real estate has been traditionally cheaper and there's more room, that's where companies are going to expand. It does have to do a lot with costs. And so we saw that in Texas, for instance. That's an area where there's going to be a lot of job growth. And Nevada, although that's, you know, that some of the places in Nevada have had some crazy real estate spikes. But we think there's a lot of space there and there's going to be room for companies to grow. Also, there's a strong hospitality industry there. And as, you know, baby boomers get older, they're going to be doing more of that kind of living the retired life when they can get to it. And Florida, too, is going to be a lot of growth, again, because baby boomers, Florida tends to be a place where people retire to. There's going to be a growth in healthcare and other services to cater to the older population.
Well, as Florida rises, so does Georgia. We see more job opportunities there. By the way, the state's losing job growth, Michigan, Ohio, Vermont, Connecticut, and Wisconsin. But what kinds of jobs will there be? We know there's going to be an increase in healthcare-related jobs and information technology. But we see in your graphs a growth of jobs in veterinary work and makeup artists. We know traditionally in economic downturns, the field of cosmetics grows. People cut back, but then they do spend on small things like lipstick. So maybe they want to learn how to put it on.
Yeah, and percentage-wise, those professions are growing a lot. What surprised us was the amount of high-touch positions that we think are going to be part of the workforce, that in the future, a lot of what companies are going to do is more hand-holding, more kind of direct interaction with the consumer. And so we saw a lot of retail salespersons and also customer representatives. Companies are doing whatever they can to get that interaction with the customers, build brands, build communities. I mean, you know, Twitter, Facebook, it's all about social networking. And so companies are spending more time to build communities around their brands. That was something interesting. We also, going into this, because we had a large article planned on where green technology and green industry and how many jobs that's going to create. If you look through our package, you see that that article shrunk a little bit. It's because we found that it's not as promising as you think. Yes, it is going to create new jobs. It is an important new industry for the U.S. economy. But a lot of the jobs that go into the green economy are existing jobs. It's a lot of overlap with what we already do. One example, wind turbines. Wind turbines are made out of steel, and that's an industry we already have. So yes, there's going to be new demand for steel, but mostly from the steel workers that are already there.
Yeah. Time magazine reporters also note that Americans are going to make stuff again. 15% will be the projected total growth in U.S. manufacturing over the next 5 years. Your reporters point out that these may be foreign-owned companies, but it's still going to be American workers doing the work.
Yes. So what we were saying is that typically the line is that the U.S. manufacturing industry is dying and it's all going to be a service economy. And what we found is, no, there's a lot of manufacturing that goes on in America, and it's a growing area of our economy. But it's different. You know, it's not cars. The manufacturing going on here is more high tech. We found seamstresses. Jobs for seamstresses were going up. Well, these aren't seamstresses making clothing. These are seamstresses making heart valves. And so the types of manufacturing jobs we're going to have here are going to be more skilled, but we're still going to have seamstresses and people working on, as we said, steel. They're just going to be for new types of industries, not what we've experienced in the past.
But back to the office worker. What is the office going to look like?
The office space may not be one space. It might be workers working from all different types of places. It also might be workers grouped together. This has to do with the generational friction and these younger generation coming in, the Generation Yers. They're used to working in groups more than the older workers who are used to like going to an office and working all day by themselves. The Generation Yers are much more interactive people. And so we think that in the future, workspaces are going to be more of two extremes. It'll either be people coming to one area and working in a common space, or people working in diverse areas out of their own spaces in their own kind of time. And again, this has to do with the Generation Yers who put flexibility first, so companies are going to be willing to kind of cater to that.
So let's close on that thought, Stephen Gandell, what the office is or isn't going to look like, because this article is written by a blogger who says some interesting things. He says, yeah, it's going to be more people working in groups, but that's going to have sort of a tribal feel, like a three-legged race. Everybody in the group has to work hard because if someone doesn't, they're going to pull the other people down. And also, if you bother to go into work, to commute and go into work, it's going to have to be really working, no goofing off. Otherwise, why would you spend the money to go, the gas, the expense and everything to go to work? It's an interesting take on what future work might feel like.
Yeah, that's the feeling, is that there's going to be a premium on going to work, that it won't be a given that every single person is going to get up in the morning and commute. There might actually be a choice for you. Do you want to commute or not? And so hopefully this will save costs. And when we have these questions about, you know, how is the U.S. economy going to survive, one of the ways is going to be companies are going to be more flexible in figuring out how to kind of adapt to this changing environment.
Stephen Gendel, senior writer for Time magazine, also one of the reporters on the series of articles entitled The Future of Work. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
And as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or anything on the program. Just go to our website, hereandnow.org, and click on Contact Us to send an email or leave a message on the phone. Or you can click on Comments to leave a comment right there on the homepage. That's hereandnow.org. Still ahead, the elephant in the zoo. Some zoos are deciding elephants shouldn't be in the zoos. That's still ahead. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. Welcome back to Here and Now. And let's turn now to the Asian nation of Burma, also known as Myanmar, where the trial of pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi is now in its eighth day. Suu Kyi, the head of the opposition party in Burma, stands accused of violating the terms of her house arrest after that bizarre incident when American John Yetow of Falcon, Missouri, swam across a lake uninvited to her home. Suu Kyi's lawyer said she was irritated by Yetow's arrival, but allowed him to stay when he said he was exhausted. She spent 13 of the last 19 years in detention, and if convicted in this trial, could face up to 5 more years of prison. Tin Tar Shwe is head of the BBC's Burmese service. Shwe, John Yetow is a father of 6, a Vietnam War vet. He was in court today telling his story. What did he say?
He testified for 3 hours from what we gathered. This is what Aung San Suu Kyi's lawyer told us. And all he said was he was sent here by with the wish of the God. The God sent me here. He repeatedly said that. And he came here to warn Aung San Suu Kyi. He had a dream that Aung San Suu Kyi's life is in danger. So he wanted to warn her. That's why he came to Burma. And he swam across the lake because no other way he could get to her house.
It's so bizarre. He is a devout Mormon, so he's very spiritual. His wife, Betty, described him as eccentric but peace-loving. So for 3 hours, apparently, he told this story. What has Suu Kyi said about him?
From what we gathered, she didn't say much. When she was questioned about his intrusion into her compound, and she said, he was a person who's intruded into my compound, so you should ask a question to him and not to me. That's all she said.
Well, this trial has been widely condemned. President Obama has called it a show trial. Is it assumed that there is something else going on here? Her house arrest was soon to end, wasn't it?
It is supposed to end today on the 27th May. She was put under house arrest 5 years ago on the 27th of May. And according to the domestic law, she cannot be detained more than 5 years. However, yesterday, the police official gave a very brief press briefing saying that her house arrest according to the calculation, is 4 years and 6 months. So she still could be detained for another 6 months. But on humanitarian ground, they decided to lift the house arrest. Ironically enough, she is not under house arrest anymore, but she is in prison at the moment.
Because of this swim across the lake and Burmese Myanmar officials accusing her of harboring John Yet Tao for 2 days. Well, part of the international condemnation of the trial is that many see it as a ploy to keep Suu Kyi in detention until after the 2010 elections. As we said, she's the head of the opposition party. She's been disputing the legitimacy of the upcoming elections. Is there a sense that that is going to be how this is going to be played out, that she will be held and maybe Ye Tao be given as the excuse just to keep her detained through the elections?
I think that is precisely what they meant to do to her.
What are Burmese people saying about this trial?
The Burmese people are very upset. They're very angry. And when the news broke that she was taken to prison, the whole city, the town, Rangoon, was dead silent. It was very quiet, very eerie feeling. They couldn't believe that the officials would take such harsh measure against her just to make sure that she would remain under detention.
That's Tin Tar Shwe, head of the BBC's Burmese service, on the ongoing trial of pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Now in its eighth day. Shui, any sense of what might happen to Ye Tao? Is he under arrest?
He is, what we gather, is in detention. He's been accused on 3 charges. And under the domestic law, if he is liable to the charges against him, then he could be prison as long as 10 years.
Shui, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And we'll continue to follow that story and a couple other stories in the works here at Here and Now. The class of Katrina will speak to several New Orleans college grads about why they've decided to stay put. Also, rereading The Grapes of Wrath. Many towns are combining book readings with job fairs. How does John Steinbeck's novel resonate today? Closing arguments were recently heard in a federal court in Washington, D.C. that might affect whether elephants will continue to perform in the circus. Animal welfare groups have sued Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey for allegedly mistreating the animal. A final ruling is expected this summer. But it's not the only elephant controversy around. In this excerpt from the public radio documentary From Cages to Conservation, American Zoos Inside Out, producer Diane Toomey reports that zoos are also coming under scrutiny, with some critics saying elephants just don't belong there.
In 1993, a video was leaked to the public. It shows a female elephant at the Milwaukee Zoo tied to the ground by all 4 legs with block and tackle. A keeper repeatedly drags a bull hook, a 2 to 3 foot long metal rod with a sharp curved end, over the elephant's back. As he does so, she struggles against her restraints. A second keeper walks to the other side of the elephant and swings his bull hook at the animal. Video was made for the training of elephant keepers. The Milwaukee Zoo practiced a method of elephant management still in use at some zoos today. It allows the keeper carrying the bull hook to be in the same enclosure as the animal, which is particularly useful for zoos that offer visitor interactions with elephants. Proponents of this kind of training say it should never involve abuse. And the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, the organization that accredits American zoos, as well as the local DA's office, found none at the Milwaukee Zoo. Still, the public outcry pressured the zoo to transfer the elephant to a sanctuary in San Andreas, California. It's run by the Performing Animal Welfare Society.
Every time I see that tape, I think, why doesn't she kill me? Everybody.
Ed Stewart is the co-founder of PAWS.
She should. Most elephants should want to kill everybody. I don't know how they put up with what they've been through.
The elephant, named Annie, now spends her days roaming a 40-acre grassy enclosure.
I have to call her so she doesn't get startled. Annie, banana! Annie, banana! Annie. Good girl, Ann.
Stuart says her favorite pastimes are swimming in ponds, bathing in the mud, and munching on carrots. He says the elephants here live an independent life, one that resembles a wild existence. But there's one accredited zoo that believes it's providing elephants with just that. Jeff Kinsley is the elephant manager at the Oakland Zoo. He says it takes plenty of staff and loads of energy to replicate a wild elephant's lifestyle.
The rest of our day, after we get done with our morning routine with the elephants, is strictly cleaning and feeding and providing more enrichment to the elephants all day long.
Come on, man. Come on, Madunda. Put...
Oakland uses a system of elephant management in which the keeper is never inside the animal's enclosure and never carries a bullhook. And when the elephant is asked to do something, like lift its foot to be scrubbed, it's free to turn down the request. So how do keepers get their elephants to cooperate? Food, of course. And what's the treat today?
Watermelon. And she loves watermelon.
All right, mate. Switch.
Half the elephants in AZA zoos are managed in this way, but Oakland was one of the first to adopt this system. Director Joel Parrott says he saw a real difference in his elephants when the bullhook was taken out of the equation.
They were no longer required to do anything. They no longer had to be disciplined. They no longer had to be dominated. And it just was a profound awakening for us to see how important that was, the happiness of the elephant.
Oakland's program is considered one of the top in the country, but some remain adamant. Elephants do not belong in zoos. These days, city councils, major newspapers, scientists, and even celebrities are weighing in. Here's actress Lily Tomlin adding her voice to a recent protest.
To continue building a habitat that is inadequate and irresponsible toward an elephant's well-being is just unconscionable.
Tomlin and others wanted the Los Angeles Zoo to send its lone elephant to a sanctuary instead of expanding its exhibit and getting more animals. But Tomlin points to an issue at the center of the debate. Do zoos provide enough space for elephants? Chris Veers is the executive director of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. She maintains the AZA's space requirements are both well-researched and sufficient.
Our elephant experts, who have hundreds of hours in managing elephants, got together and discussed this for weeks on end, determining what do elephants need for good care, and they came up with that particular standard.
The AZA standards for elephants are a joke.
Catherine Doyle is the elephant welfare specialist with In Defense of Animals, an animal welfare organization that opposes keeping elephants in zoos.
Their minimum standard outdoors is for keeping an elephant is 1,800 square feet, which is about the size of a 3-car garage. Indoors, they can be kept in a pen as small as 20 by 20 feet.
Space is no small matter for an elephant.
Those feet were made for a purpose. And if you don't allow that purpose to occur, then the elephant suffers from it.
Mel Richardson is the veterinarian at the Paws Sanctuary and has worked at a number of zoos across the country. He says that small enclosures can cause arthritis and foot infections, common problems that can lead to euthanasia.
They're put to sleep because they can't get up, they can't move, they can no longer stand the pain.
These kinds of foot problems aren't seen in the wild, says Joyce Poole. She's a longtime elephant researcher who led the Amboseli Elephant Research Project in Kenya.
Our older elephants walk the same as younger elephants. Okay, a bit slower. They don't have that sort of bounce in their gait, but they're not limping along like many elephants that you see in captivity.
A small number of AZA zoos, for a variety of reasons, have either shut down or are phasing out their elephant exhibits. But the AZA's Chris Veers maintains the animal belongs in zoos.
Elephants should be in zoological environments. We only really take care of what we love and what we know, and we provide our elephants with great care. We love them, and they are wonderful conservation ambassadors.
So is there a middle ground, a way for zoos to exhibit their elephants but provide them a life comparable to one in the wild? Maybe. Elephant researcher Joyce Poole says if zoos must keep their elephants, they should place them in large, really large enclosures where they could live a fairly autonomous life. Think safari in North America.
To drive up and sit and watch elephants doing their own thing is just a glorious experience. And you don't have to constantly be adjusting and controlling their behavior in order to appreciate elephants. Elephant power.
That last word on elephants from researcher Joyce Poole. From Cages to Conservation, American Zoos Inside Out is a documentary produced by our home station, WBUR Boston, with producers Diane Toomey and Christina Russo. It's airing on public stations across the country. Check your local station for times. And for more on zoos, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Up next, you can bring the yoga neophyte to class, but you can't make him enlighten up. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Have you noticed? Yoga is everywhere, a multi-billion dollar industry with many modern takes on a practice that's as old as... How old is it?
It was 40,000 years ago that this Kundalini yoga started.
That's a good question. I don't know too much the history.
Some figures I've seen are 5,000 years.
Several yoga superstars who open a new documentary on what everyone can agree is an old practice. Filmmaker Kate Churchill, a yoga student, set out to answer her own questions about yoga, especially whether or not it could deliver spiritual benefits as well as a physical workout. She recruited Nick Rosen, a New York-based journalist and rock climber, to undertake 6 months of yoga training around the world. He's a yoga novice, and we soon learn something of a yoga cynic.
I find myself intimidated by the yoga project. Spiritual awakening is a concept I cannot even relate to at this moment.
But Nick dutifully travels across country to Hawaii and eventually to India with the ever-present Kate and her camera. The resulting film is called Enlighten Up, and filmmaker Kate Churchill joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We're also joined from his office in Colorado, where he now lives, by Nick Rosen. Nick, namaste.
Namaste. Glad to be here.
I didn't know how you'd react to that. Loosely translated, namaste means I bow to you, but some in yoga classes say it means the God in me bows to the God in you. You characterize for us your feelings going into this project about spirituality and yoga.
Well, I think your point about namaste hits home, because one of the things that stuck in my craw the most about yoga was that we would chant all of this Sanskrit, a language which I don't understand, and I don't think most people understand who take yoga class. The cynic in me would say that that somehow polluted the experience.
Is it fair to say, Kate, now you tell me if I'm wrong, that the divide that emerges between the two of you is you want Nick to have a spiritual awakening. Nick, because Kate wanted you to have it, you maybe couldn't have it. I mean, Kate, is that, have I got that?
Yeah, I wanted this guy to be levitating 50 feet off the ground and his eyeballs glowing maybe 4 or 5 months into our six-month journey. I wanted full pass to enlightenment.
And Nick, did I have that right, that the more Kate was sort of off-camera urging you to have this enlightenment, the less you could have it?
Maybe so, yeah. I have to admit that at the outset, as naive as it sounds, I did think that perhaps I would get some kind of spiritual or deeply philosophical benefit from all of this.
Well, Kate, it's a travelogue of a who's who in yoga starting across the U.S. Tick off some of the practices and some of the gurus that you met.
Well, we start in New York City, and there we meet people like Cindy Lee of Om Yoga and Alan Finger, Sharon Gannon and David Life of Jivamukti Yoga. But then as we cross the country, we meet an interesting guy, Diamond Dallas Page, with Yoga for Regular Guys.
I want to stop you there. This is the former professional wrestling champion who went into yoga after an injury. His approach is more, how to do this for family radio.
Profane.
Yeah. Let's listen to how he describes his yoga.
Ours is about the workout, you know, and sweating your ass off. When you get to India and you got some guy doing it, I want you to walk up and blast him with the chair.
Kate, there's one frame. We see you walking through the frame at the end of the yoga session with Diamond Dallas Page, and you look absolutely disgusted.
Yeah, I was not having fun.
Because what? This offended what in you?
Nick really liked him. And I found it like, oh no, this is going to take our plan way off course if Nick starts following this former pro wrestler, you know?
Well, and it's not like I was ready to, like, follow Diamond Dallas Page around.
No.
You know, but we had been hanging out with so many very sanctimonious people and very serious yoga practitioners. I think I was just refreshed to be around someone who was irreverent.
Well, then you do both get to India. Nick, what happened for you in India?
Well, India was intense on many levels. I mean, this was the final 2 months of principal photography for this yoga project, and so I was running out of time. Kate was running out of time. I wasn't having my spiritual awakening, and Kate was impatient about that, and I was angry that Kate was getting impatient.
Well, and Kate, this, of course, as an observer, is a huge irony, because all of these wonderful gurus that you're meeting are seeing this and saying, this is the opposite of yoga.
It's exactly that. While we are spending our days with these incredible teachers, I mean, Patabi Joyce of Ashtanga Yoga, who actually just passed away last week, BKS Iyengar, probably the most influential person on the physical practice in the West. You know, we're spending our days with these people, and the lessons they're teaching us are so completely in contradiction to how we're acting.
Kate getting increasingly snappy, and you, Nick, sort of having a, I don't know, breakdown, breakthrough. They're sometimes the same. And there's another storyline going on here. When we meet you in the beginning of the film, we meet your dad, who is a very straight-laced attorney, and your mom, who's a flowers-in-her-hair shaman. She's a healer. And something happens for you when you're in India. What happened? And is it the yoga?
Well, I think whatever the cause, I did start to have some pretty strong feelings about my mother, someone who, you know, we've, as many people do with their mothers, wrestled with our relationship. And I started to feel acutely that how important she was in my life and how I needed to honor that and honor her and rebuild our relationship a little bit.
Well, and you ultimately moved back to Colorado and maybe we presume spend some more time with her. But Kate, for you, you know, one thing we've been told over and over over the years that sets old practices that have been adapted in the new age apart from things like religions that are supposed to proselytize is that yoga or 12-step practices are supposed to be based on attraction rather than promotion. In other words, you can't push someone into it. They will find their own path in their own time.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. During the course of the film, I mean, I definitely had an agenda, too. I thought, wow, he'll become so enlightened that I'll naturally become enlightened as well, you know. And it really took the course of making the film, which took me 5 years, to realize the depth of the truth, how nobody can tell you which path to walk, and nobody can walk that path for
you.
So
you did become enlightened.
Perhaps. I mean, I think what we ended up doing in the film was perhaps the most aware work that I've created yet.
How about you, Nick? You feeling a little enlightened?
I think that, you know, just the very modest and incremental realization that I had about my relationship with my mother is huge to me and as big as anyone should expect from any kind of practice or experience. And so if that's enlightenment, I'll take it.
That's Nick Rosen, star of Kate Churchill's documentary exploring the possible spiritual benefits of yoga. It's called Enlighten Up. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Thank you both so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.